Don Olmeyer. Weekend Update is what gets you to midnight. You tune in, and there'll be a couple of weak sketches, and there might be a sketch that works, and then a couple that don't work, and that's the nature of the show. But you grew up knowing that Weekend Update was coming. I'm going to stay tuned until update. That's part of the brilliance of Lauren's construction of the show, that you have this thing at midnight that would hold people there for the first half hour, even if some of the sketches in the first half hour weren't that strong. In 1996, and again to an even greater degree in 2000, Saturday Night Live returned to its richest vein of humor, American politics, and in the process the show rejuvenated itself for the umpty-umpth time. The cast was prodigious, the writing team witty and self-confident, the satire biting. Daryl Hammond, one of the most gifted impressionists in the show's mimicry history, mastered Bill Clinton, Jesse Jackson, and the hard-to-impersonate Al Gore. And on nights when announcer Don Pardo was unavailable, Hammond would fill in for him, unbeknownst to viewers, with another spot-on impersonation. Will Ferrell, the cast's most versatile utility player, made his version of George W. Bush easily as iconic as Chevy Chase's Gerald Ford of a quarter century earlier. Ferrell's impression was accurate, hilarious, and inspired. The faux Ford and the bogus Bush were blood brothers. Saturday Night Live seemed to have come full circle, back to its roots. Those predicting the show's demise skulked back into the shadows, poised, of course, to return at any given moment. Ratings rose, the show surged again in popularity, and the real Al Gore and his aides studied SNL's parody of a presidential debate to help understand where Gore had gone wrong with his own debate performance. Al Gore, host. That is true, actually. It's not that I set about to use it. It is true, though, that during the prep for the second debate, somebody brought in the tape. I didn't ask to see it or consciously use it as a tool, but somebody brought it in and said, "You should watch this." And I think it was a way of that person, I can't remember who it was, making a point that the first debate gave grist to the mill for lampooning the sighing and so forth, and that sort of critique that came after the first debate. I think it did have an effect, yes. And I thought it was very funny. Rudolph Giuliani, host. Some of my political advisors said it was a bad idea for me to host Saturday Night Live. Absolutely. Some of them thought either you could step over the line and do something really offensive to people. It's one thing for comedians to do that, but it's another thing for politicians to do it. Or you could really make a fool out of yourself, where you could stand out there for an hour and a half and nobody would laugh at anything. But of the experiences I had while I was mayor, that was one of the most enjoyable. It was just a great experience. I had been on the show once before that. I had opened the show with Governor Pataki, in which we got into this argument about, is it like New York City or New York State? And so I was familiar with the show to that extent. But the idea of doing the whole thing, at first I didn't think I could do it, and Lorne convinced me I could, and I'm glad I did. The response was wonderful. It was absolutely wonderful. When I hosted, I found that the excitement level of doing live television really adds a tremendous amount to the show. Oh, sure, I was nervous. I'd never done that before. I did a lot of public speaking of all different kinds, and I had performed maybe 3 or 4 times with the Inner Circle up until then. But I never had to, like, carry all those different skits. But it was great, great fun. It was much less difficult than I thought it would be because of Lorne and how professional they all are. They really take you through it, and they sort of teach you how to do it. Lorne organizes the show like a lawyer organizes a great trial. He has a whole pattern and format for it, and it turns out that the show was done in the same office building in which I practiced law for 4 years, so I spent a week preparing it, and I felt like I was back preparing for a big trial. They wanted me to do a whole mango thing that I thought really was, you know, we didn't want to do that. I thought, oh my goodness, that would create quite a stir. Wearing a dress almost accomplished the same thing. Then in the dress rehearsal version, there were 1 or 2 skits that they cut out. They thought other ones were funnier. I remember there was one about the Statue of Liberty, where I played a park ranger giving a description of the Statue of Liberty and, like, getting out of control. like I was in love with the Statue of Liberty. And there was another one where I did a press conference, and there was like a nephew of mine who was jumping all over me. But those were just cut as part of the normal process they go through. Of the various skits that I did, the one I liked the best was probably the one where I played the taxi driver, and then maybe the one where I played the Italian grandmother was second. In the others, I more or less played myself, but in those I got to create a character, and it was just a lot of fun to do that. Since the night I hosted the show, I've probably dropped by it half a dozen times, 4 to 6 times. I enjoy watching it. I enjoy watching it live as well as watching it on television. I've enjoyed it from the very beginning. I remember Chevy Chase playing President Ford. Now, I worked for President Ford and loved him, and I still thought the humor was great. It was just great. Daryl Hammond, cast member. The first time I met Lorne, I had just had a root canal. I was, like, dripping. I can remember I felt like blood was going to come pouring out of my mouth. I met him in that studio, no one else in there but a couple of camera people. He shook my hand and asked me to sit down and said to perform. He goes, "You okay?" I said, "Yeah." He goes, "All right, go ahead whenever you're ready." That's the first time I met him. I auditioned for him 3 more times, and then I had a long dinner with him after that, and I guess it was shortly after that he hired me.
Marcy Klein, co-producer. Daryl's a huge talent. When his audition tape got put in the machine, I wasn't really paying attention. And all of a sudden, he was doing Phil Donahue, and I was like, holy shit! I could not believe he sounded so much like the real thing. It almost scared me because I thought, he's too good.
Will Ferrell, cast member. I was hired for the first 9 shows, and they were going to pick me up, and that was changed to the next 6 shows, and after that it was whether you were going to be picked up for the next year. And then after that it was year by year, and so you always feel like you're a little bit on shaky ground. When I got hired, I found an apartment, and I was like, well, I better take the subway a lot before the first show starts, because once that first show starts, I won't be able to take the subway. And I still ride the subway, so I don't know. I think it's different. It's definitely a gradual thing in terms of auditioning and meeting Lorne for the first time. We were seen at the Groundlings, and then there was like the first round of auditions, and then there was a callback round in which you met with Lorne the day before, and then you auditioned again. And then in our case, they flew back out and they saw us again at the Groundlings, and it was 6 weeks before we got hired. After I made like the first cut, I knew that I was going to have to meet Lorne. I had read somewhere that Adam Sandler did a bit where he humped a chair like a dog when he met Lorne and was signed on the spot. Like, that was it for Adam Sandler. I thought, when I meet Lorne Michaels, I'm not going to be trite. I'm going to do something funny. I'm going to be really funny. So, my idea was that I filled up a briefcase full of money that I bought at a toy store, and while he was talking to me, I would open the briefcase and start piling fake money on his desk and just say, "You know what, Lorne? You can talk all you want, but I'm going to walk out of this room. I'm not going to know what happened to this money. You either take it or leave it." That was going to be my big thing, and just walk out. Well, as soon as I walked in with my briefcase, I could tell that the atmosphere was not right for it. Lorne's first thing he said to me was, "Okay, so you're funny. You were funny during the first audition. I hope you're funny tomorrow, because consistency is what we're looking for." I was just like, oh, God. And here's Steve Higgins, who'd been hired the day before, just looking at me. I mean, what comedian walks in with a leather briefcase sitting in their lap? I'm just uncomfortable, knowing I have a briefcase full of fake money. Then it was all superseded by asking me what I was going to plan to audition with the following day. The second audition was to be like 5 minutes of what you want to do on the first show. Okay, does that mean stuff that I had done on the first audition that seemed to work, or do you want new stuff? He essentially wanted to see all brand new stuff, so meanwhile I'm thinking, oh my God. So I walked out and they kind of took me through the paces. No, I wouldn't do that. They conveyed to me that they'd seen me do this one thing in the audition and wanted to see if I could cover this other area. And Steve is just looking at me, and it's like, Steve, do you have anything you want to ask Will? And Steve's like, nice briefcase. So then I walked out, never having opened it, and did the second audition. Then a couple of weeks later, Lorne came out to see the Groundlings, and in the following week I had to meet him at the Paramount lot, not knowing that this was the meeting. Marcy called and said, Lorne wants to meet with you again. Don't worry, it's nothing bad. But I didn't put it together that he was going to be hiring me. I just thought, oh, he wants to get to know me. So, here I am at the Paramount lot. I was like, damn, I got a second chance. I'm going to bring my briefcase. I'm going to do the money bit here if I'm ever going to do it. And then, Lauren's ready to see you. Oh, you can just set your briefcase down. Don't worry about it. We talked for 20 minutes, and he told me I was hired. And then I walked out, and I just quickly explained to the people outside, can you guys just give him some of this fake money? It was this idea I had a long time ago, and I never got to do it. That's why I always had this briefcase with me. And then I guess he laughed really hard when he heard the whole thing. I still have the briefcase. Yeah. Steve Higgins. Around here you brave the storm. That's the only way I can think of it. You just brave it. When it's a sunny day, you can frolic on deck, and when it's stormy, you cling to the mast. An interesting election year is good for us. This last one with Downey and the cold openings on the debates, that's what really swung everything. People loved the show again. When it's the political stuff, the best is when somebody who's a Democrat goes, oh, you really gave it to Bush, and somebody who's a Republican will go, oh, you really laid into Gore. That's the reaction we should be getting. Ralph Nader. The whole thing in 2000 was bizarre. Here you have this serious presidential campaign, and all of us had to go on these comedy shows like Saturday Night Live, because that was the only way we could have more than a soundbite and reach a large audience. This is the land of the free, the home of the brave. 285 million people with endless numbers of channels, and they're all closed off. James Downey. Someone did a survey of college students on where they got their political views and information, and television comedy was number one, ahead of newspapers or discussions on campus or even TV news. I don't think it's a crazy thing to say that SNL was one of the things that influenced voters in the 2000 election. Certainly after the first debate, followed up by the first debate sketch, there was an awful lot of talk. I know that because I was taping the talk show commentaries. I happened to be watching the Brit Hume show on Fox after the first debate sketch, and something made me think, hey, they're going to show a clip from the debate sketch. And that was, I think, the very first use of it. I kept hearing reports from people that they did it on CNN, or there was something on the Today Show, that sort of thing. And then it became a standard thing that I would keep tabs on. Nowadays, they practically have a regular slot. There's a fair use doctrine or something. They don't have to pay any kind of licensing fee to run a short clip if they're a news program, because they can argue this is a form of news. So, especially on Mondays, they will have a clip of something we did on the show on Saturday. I thought our first Bush-Gore debate piece was perfectly even-handed. I think maybe some people were used to a more traditional approach, where we're only rough on Republicans, at least really rough. The old style of the show was that the way you'd hit Democrats would be to say guys like Carter and Dukakis were just too brainy and intellectual and didn't understand that ordinary people weren't following them, or that they were too detail-oriented and needed to slow down. I guess that's a criticism, but it's nothing like portraying the other side as cretins or criminals. Over the years, I think there have been some heavy-handed elements to the political stuff we've done. I think we've done a lot of good stuff, too. To me, it's most fun when the tone is silly and there's no anger and our stance is wise-ass, uninvolved detachment. I think that works better for everybody. We don't like to think we're getting laughs by just saying George W. Bush is an idiot. There has to be more to it than that. Rudolph Giuliani. I actually think Saturday Night Live's political humor is among its best. When you think of the imitations of President Ford, plus they had two different great imitations of President Clinton, yeah, I think their political humor has been absolutely terrific. Do I think it has an actual effect on people politically? Gee, I don't know. It doesn't for me, because I take it as humor. So when they've made fun of me, or made fun of basically my heroes or the Republicans that I like, I know they've made equal fun of Democrats, so it doesn't offend me. I think some people kind of watch it selectively. I don't think it has a big political effect in that sense. They made equal fun of Gore and Bush, so I think politically it ends up a wash. They never did anything about me that I objected to. They did a great skit of my first inaugural, where my son disrupted the ceremony. I always saw it as humor. Daryl Hammond. I got to meet Clinton in the White House, and it was like seeing the largest, strongest, smartest dog in a compound. He was so sure of himself, and he so loved being the president, and he seduced everybody in that room. I mean, this guy would walk down the rope line and remember the shit about your sister or your brother that's most crucial to you. That instinct for creating a moment is just gigantic. I've studied Bill Clinton for years, and I haven't once ever caught him posturing or being phony. He just can't. And yet when you see a guy who's that gifted, you think, well, he's got to be staging this. I guess I went about 3 months before I ever got a handle on him. He was the hardest thing I've ever done. And then my instinct told me, he's doing John Kennedy. He's doing John Kennedy. So I learned Clinton by practicing JFK's inaugural address in a southern accent. At one of those correspondence dinners in Washington, I opened with this joke about Clinton's charisma. He's the kind of guy that would say to a woman, and get away with it, "If you would only take your clothes off and let me see you naked, there would be no more white racism, I swear to God." And in that split second, I looked out the corner of my eye, and it was almost as if I could see that machinery clicking and whirring, and he reached over to the African-American woman sitting next to him, and he gives her a big kiss on the cheek. It was beautiful, and the place went nuts, and I thought, how does he do it? Clinton said something at another correspondence dinner like, "Poor Daryl, what is he going to do when I leave office?" I spent about 20 minutes alone with Clinton once. Him and the shooters, I guess there were a couple of gunmen there from the Secret Service. And man, he was nice as hell to me. Just so complimentary, knew everything I had ever said. He asked me to do him. Sure, and I did. One time I did a correspondence dinner where I played his clone. He faked a leg injury, and I had to come up and finish the speech, oh yeah, and he was like, "And how would you say this line? How would you say that line?" With Gore, on the other hand, you could see the puppet and the puppeteer. You know, the Wizard of Oz. Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain. That was Gore to me. He had no ability to mask what he was feeling or thinking. We could see him trying really hard, and in a way that's kind of endearing. On SNL, we're looking for the jugular. If it comes up on the Republican side, we'll hit it. You can't educate an audience and get them to laugh at the same time. You have to find out what it is that they're feeling at that moment and hit it. They basically should be somewhat in agreement with you on their laughter. Andy Breckman. Lorne defers to Downey to this degree. If Downey says, "I have an idea for a political piece, I don't know what it is, I haven't written it yet, but I will write it," Lorne will block out the 6 minutes and build the set without having seen or heard the premise. If a Downey sketch is coming in, that's our cold opening, build the set. We'll get the pages maybe the night before, if we're lucky. Don Olmeyer. Downey and Franken are great political satirists, and they always have been. Election years are always very strong years for the show. And they have an ability to get right to the heart of the matter. They don't necessarily stop at the superficial. I think they've done a fabulous job with, it's a terrible thing to say, but I mean this whole situation with terrorism is such a fertile ground for what SNL does. It's kind of like playing to their strength. It gives them characters that are in the forefront of the public mind to spoof. James Downey. Nowadays, since I came back again after being fired as update guy, I sort of have a mandate to write topical political stuff, although I do other kinds of things too. I'm not always happy, not only with choices made about my own stuff, but choices in general. I'd like to see more of the sort of pieces where it's about the premise or the conceit, and not about a popular returning character. But at least these days I never have to be in the position of being the guy who's the reason someone else's piece didn't get on, or rewriting someone else. So that's nice. I get to just write. Daryl Hammond. I was glad to hear that Ted Koppel likes my impression of him, because I admire him, and I don't want him to think I'm a schmuck, you know? I mean, some of those guys you just admire. Plus, we didn't really take shots at Koppel, and you can't. How do you take a shot at an esteemed journalist who, by every indication, is a pretty good guy and trying to contribute, you know? You don't take shots at him. What you do is to take him and put him somewhere he would not normally be. In a bathtub, having a bubble bath, you know what I mean. I actually performed for Koppel at a tribute for him at the Museum of Broadcasting. It's very strange, because I went there in full Koppel drag. I had the hair and the nose, and I had a bit prepared, and they told me that I was to wait until Sam Donaldson got up to give his appreciation of Ted, and then I should walk in and interrupt him. And I thought, okay. And so Donaldson is up there, and I walk in, and I'm like, "Excuse me?" And when I look into Koppel's eyes, right, I got so scared. And I got so scared I could only say to him, this is what was embarrassing, I could only say it in his voice. I said, "Are you mad at me?" I couldn't help it. And he goes, "No, I'm not mad at you. Give me the microphone." And then he takes the mic, and he, like, grabs the wig I'm wearing, and he goes, "Rune, you cheap bastard, if you paid me a living wage, I could afford a decent rug like this one." And the place went nuts. The first cast of Saturday Night Live had lacked one thing that all subsequent groups would enjoy: access to the work of predecessors. When the show was new, it had no models and barely a template. They made it up as they went along, and many improvisations born of desperation became traditions and tenets. Members of succeeding casts were always haunted by the first, its taped work recycled perpetually in reruns, and put to the challenge of trying to equal its impact. In the 1980s, 1990s, and 2000s, the show that had been designed for the TV generation was passed along to the SNL generation, talented kids whose earliest memories of watching the show were among their earliest memories of watching, or maybe even doing, anything. Now the Saturday Night Live creative team, before the cameras and behind them, included people younger than the show itself, video-age babies who'd never known a TV universe without it. Jimmy Fallon. I'm the same age as the show. When I first saw it, I was like 7 or 8 years old. My parents used to tape it and show me and my sister only the clean sketches. The others were too risque for us, so we couldn't watch the whole thing. They were good censors, because we thought it was a treat just to see anything funny, especially Mr. Bill. I don't know why, but Wild and Crazy Guys was our favorite. It was risque, but we didn't realize as kids what things like birth control devices or tight bulges meant. We were just little kids. We used to perform the sketches at parties, and relatives would be like, "You'll let your kids say this?" But I had no idea what it meant.
Rachel Dratch, cast member. I've watched the show since its beginning. I was really young. I'd watch it every Saturday and have friends over and make them stay up to watch the show. It was like a ritual of mine. Gilda Radner was my favorite. Looking back, the thing I loved about her was just, I don't know, you never saw a woman comedian. There was no separation, no gender thing. Being in Chicago and hearing women aren't funny and all that stuff, I liked her the most. Sherry O'Teary, cast member. I grew up on the old shows. I remember my mom would let us stay up because it became such a treat. It was a time when you should have gone to bed, but we were up, and I remember to this day my favorites are Bill Murray and Gilda Radner, because I laughed and I related to their characters. I loved their characters. I would recognize when someone else was funny, even if they weren't necessarily my type of humor. But when Bill Murray hosted here that time, it was amazing. This writer that I write with, we got into a huge fight. It was a brawl, I mean screaming and everything. We were screaming so hard at each other. And when you walk out after a fight like that, you're shaking, because you can't believe it got that heated and violent. So I walk out after it's over, and there's Bill Murray standing there. He heard the whole thing, and he's like my idol. And this was the first time something like that ever happened. He just looked at me. I felt so ashamed. And the next day, I had to sit next to him at rehearsal, and I go, "I'm really sorry you had to hear that yesterday." And he said, "Sherry, I felt like I was home." Molly Shannon, cast member. I didn't watch the show as much as other people. I loved Gilda Radner and Bill Murray, but I didn't think about being on Saturday Night Live until I was in college. That wasn't always my dream for my whole childhood. It just started in college that I knew I wanted to be on that show. At NYU, I was a drama major, and I did all of these serious acting classes doing sense memory, and my God, so serious, with all these drama students, and musical theater. But then we did this review show, and Adam Sandler was in it, this little comedy sketch show, and it was the best. We made fun of the teachers with little comedy sketches, and I remember it was the most fun, and I thought, oh, I like this. We improvised and made stuff up. It felt so free. I loved the improvisation, just using your instincts, and I was like, hey, I like this comedy thing. And then I met some guy in L.A. named Rob Muir, who I did a show with, who told me, comedy is king, and I said, is comedy king? Comedy's king? Okay. And he said I should think about comedy, and then I really got into it. The first time I did my Mary Catherine Gallagher character was a long time ago at NYU, in a review show there. I didn't really base her on anyone. It's just bits and pieces, parts of myself, but an exaggerated version of myself. But then there's a lot just made up. I did Mary Catherine Gallagher in that show. Mary Catherine took a lot of falls. I would bruise myself and cut myself, but I never injured my back or anything. I started to get afraid. At first, I didn't think anything of it. It was like punk rock. I actually liked getting bruised. It felt wild and committed, and I enjoyed it. But being on TV, so many people would come up to me and go, "Do you get hurt? Do you get hurt? You must get hurt." And after thousands of people asked me, I started to get scared. So then I started to wear padding.
Steve Higgins. One of the nice things about Tom Davis coming back is that he's such a breath of fresh air. He says, "Oh, you guys are doing a great job." But any of the other writers who leave and come back, it always seems like they're saying, "My high school drama department was better. When I was here, it was way better. Now look, they're doing 10 Little Indians. Ugh, that's a horrible play." Because most of the people here, this was their first TV job, so they form so many opinions off it, and it's always that high school thing. "My football team was better." Chris Kattan, cast member. When I first saw SNL as a kid, I didn't think it was funny. When I first saw the Belushi stuff, I didn't think it was funny. I was watching Fawlty Towers and Monty Python at that age, and I was hooked on old movies like Road to Rio and Abbott and Costello. I was addicted to that stuff. I really got into Saturday Night Live when Eddie Murphy came on. He was so relaxed and had so much control and power over the audience and everything that was going on. If there were no laughs, he was still so powerful, so relaxed and comfortable. He didn't get nervous. He didn't act like, "Oh my God, this isn't working," and rush through the lines. One time, I don't know what sketch it was, he made some mistake, and the audience laughed, and he went, "Shut up!" I was like, "Wow, that was great." It's so great if you can be that relaxed and that confident. Then by the time I got to high school, I wanted to be on Saturday Night Live. I didn't know if I was good enough, but I thought, I actually feel like I might be able to make it on that show. At least I might be able to audition. I just had a gut feeling that I could do it. Right before I got here, when they had Quentin Tarantino and Tom Arnold as hosts, it wasn't that funny, and I was like, oh, God, what's happening? And I was like, I'm glad I didn't get the show. I actually auditioned with Will and everybody else, and I didn't get it. And then months later, they asked me to come on out next week all of a sudden. The first couple of years, at least for me, you can't help but take stuff so seriously about getting your sketches in, and is this going to work? And you stress out so much. I would get so stressed out and so worried about sketches, it was just a big waste of energy. But you don't learn that until you kind of let it all go. And then you just relax, and you're a better performer. Tracy Morgan, cast member. I didn't watch the show after Eddie Murphy left. That's how my community is. We stopped watching basically after Eddie left. He was like the blackest thing on TV then. Now everybody has a sitcom. So I don't know if I even want to do primetime after this, but I love doing Saturday Night Live. It's late night, it's live, baby. It's like Jackie Gleason. Once you do this show, you've made TV immortality. I'm going to be on TV the rest of my life. My grandkids will be able to see this. They'll have the marathon on cable on Thanksgiving, the Saturday Night Live marathon, and Daddy will be on it.
Paula Pell. We have a lot of two-person sketches, as opposed to big ensembles of early days. I think it's because of the way we write. We go into little offices with one or two people, and someone will have an idea for just one character. I've written some pieces with lots of people in them, but it's hard sometimes if the piece is about a certain character. You have only 5 minutes to do the sketch, and now you have somebody that has to be the center of it. Which is why I think we have a lot of talk shows and a lot of presentational things where it's like, hi, I'm my character.
Horatio Sanz, cast member. I used to watch it when I was 8, in Chicago. My brothers used to watch it. They shared a room and I'd sneak in and watch it with them. I've kind of always in the back of my mind wanted to do it. It had been a dream of mine since I was little. Then in high school you kind of think maybe it's a crazy dream. At one point I toyed with the idea of being in the CIA, but I think you have to join the army first, unless you're really smart. Then my brother started acting in college, and I'd go see his plays, and it kind of made it more like something I could see. I thought, oh, it's more tangible. So I started doing that. I quit college when I started doing improv, and I really figured that's what I wanted to do. I was at Columbia College in Chicago. I went to film and television school, and I figure that too is another thing you have to be really good at. If you want to work in the crew, you have to be really good. And I wasn't. I was in Second City. Everybody would hang out at night drinking and doing bits. That made it hard to wake up early and make class. 14 of us auditioned that year for SNL. I've auditioned all my life for things, and even when I've gotten stuff, I didn't really give it my all. Like, I auditioned for the Roseanne sketch show and In Living Color, and I never really gave it my all. I kind of just fucked around. I guess the reason was I didn't want those other shows. I wanted to wait for this show. I just prepared for this audition really well, more than anything I've ever done. I figured this is my shot, and I didn't want it to be like one of those situations where you mess it up and you're like, oh well, there'll be something else. If I don't get the show, at least I can say I did the best I could. They wanted to fly me out the day before. I wanted them to fly me out the week before so I could get acclimated with the city and practice my audition piece. So I went early, put myself in a different hotel, and I just ran my piece over and over. I was told by people that I knew on the show, they don't laugh at auditions, so don't be thrown by it. Keep doing your job. So then when I did hear laughter, that helped me out. I'm thinking, oh, this is going better than it normally does. And then I kind of felt really good about the audition. Even if I didn't get the show, I would have felt good about it. And then you go into these meetings like, oh, it's almost done. You have to meet Lorne. So then you're just waiting. And then you meet Lorne, and he goes, you did good. We liked you. I think we'd like to have you on the show. But he doesn't say you're hired. He goes, okay, you did good. We're going to bring you out. We're going to bring you out to New York. You kind of want to hear that you're hired, but he doesn't tell you. So I said, Should I tell my parents I have to move to New York? And he goes, yeah, tell them you have to move to New York, but don't tell them you'll be on the show. I guess what that means is that having the job somehow doesn't mean you're going to be around in the show.
Molly Shannon. After NYU Drama School, I moved to Los Angeles. I was auditioning for TV pilots and some commercials and stuff, but couldn't really catch a break. There were a lot of young girls my age who were getting pilots, but I wasn't. So I thought, I'm just going to focus on writing my own show and developing my own characters and improvising. A couple years before I got hired, I sent my tape to them, when they hired Ellen Cleghorn, but they didn't respond to my tape, so I just went back and worked on my show, and kept writing and developing more characters. This guy Rob Muir and I put together a two-person show called The Rob and Molly Show, and we did that for a couple of years in Los Angeles. My agent called me and he was like, Marcy Klein is coming to your show. Put it together. I did a show just for her. When I auditioned for Saturday Night Live, the person who was having the auditions for Lauren told me, whatever you do, please don't do that Mary Catherine Gallagher character. You'll never get hired. Lauren won't like that. He'll think it's disgusting and dirty. Yeah, she said it was such a disgusting, dirty little character that Lorne wouldn't like it, and whatever you do, don't do that. For some reason, she just didn't think it was right. I don't want to say her name, but I'll never forget that lady.
Tracy Morgan. You know, when I first saw Lorne Michaels, I was working at Yankee Stadium before I got into show business. It's where I met my wife 14 years ago. I used to see Lorne Michaels go in Gate 4 every day. I was selling T-shirts and all that. I was a vendor at Yankee Stadium. Now look where I'm at. It was so ironic that I met Lorne Michaels like that. And now, years later, he's my boss and I'm working on his show. I didn't know him. I was a kid from the ghetto trying to make a dollar out of 15 cents. Horatio Sanz. One prevailing frustration is kind of like not knowing where you'll be the same time next year. But I guess a lot of show business is like that. Another reason is sometimes you start thinking you deserve something. You can fall into a situation where you think, that sucks, I got screwed. But there are so many other factors involved in the show. You have to not get too high with the good and not too low with the bad to kind of be rational about it. Because whether the host likes something could affect whether it's on the show. Ultimately, it's not our show. Lorne's the producer, it's his show. He'll be here for as long as he wants. Some stay longer than others, but it's not our show. It's a shared thing. You have to take those frustrations. Things usually swing around. Like if you have a good week, you'll have a better one next week. Chris Kattan. My parents are Zen Buddhists, but that's pretty much the least crazy religion. It's not even a religion, really. I had a pretty normal childhood. My parents divorced when I was 2, and then I lived with my mother and stepfather. My mother left my dad for another man, who was also at the Zen Center thing, but they were friends with people like Leonard Cohen and things like that. We moved to a place called Mount Baldy that was in a mountain, a very secluded area. I lived there from like age 4 to 12, and I think I went a little crazy up there. I think I really did, because there was nothing to do. I mean, you're in a mountain, and I guess kids should be around other kids. Like at age 8, 9, somewhere around there, they're supposed to be around other kids, and I was not. I mean, except for school. I was a shy kid, and I didn't do very many sports, and I used to have crushes on somebody every week. I started getting obsessed with other people a little bit, just their personalities. I do a lot of observing, but observing while talking with them and stuff like that. I used to get crushes on women like once every 3 months, a different one. I would never ever kiss them or anything, because I was not that guy in school, but I would follow them around. That obsession helped me create. It's almost like I started creating for that person, to get in their good graces in a weird way. I don't know what I'll do when I get married.
Sherry O'Terry. I think some people in the cast have fun crushes on other people, but nothing serious. I guess we're kind of boring. No romances, no drugs. I had an audition once with somebody who used to work here. He's very, very big in the business now. And as soon as I went in for the audition, he went, "Hey, you guys still doing coke over at SNL? Because back when he was here, he was doing it." What are we doing, for crying out loud? Oh, yeah, thinking up characters. Tina Fey. The 70s and the 21st century are just so different. There's no drugs and there's no sex at the show now. I would have been terrified if I was back here in the old days. Maya Rudolph, cast member. We're certainly a much cleaner, healthier generation than past generations. Everybody goes to the gym now, except for me. People are eating right and taking care of themselves and not smoking and not doing drugs. I'm being very general, but it's definitely a reflection of the time and the culture we're living in. To me, it's certainly boring compared to the Saturday Night Live of yore. We always make jokes about, "I would have died if I'd been here in the 70s. I just wouldn't have made it." And then I also sometimes wish for those days, because I wish I was around when everybody was sleeping with each other. It just sounds like a lot more fun.
Chris Kattan. When I came here, I heard a lot of Chris Farley stories and stuff like that, and you're like, "Wow, really?" But now there's not too much unhealthiness. Everyone's really healthy. I mean, we all have our neuroses, obviously, or we wouldn't be here. And we wouldn't have characters that are so crazy. That's where our neurosis pops out, most likely. I wonder, in the old days, you know, did they perform high? I'm sure I've heard that Belushi was all coked up when he did this or that, you know, blah, blah, blah. But I just wouldn't be able to function. And I would not want, 20 years from now, to look back and go, "God, I was so coked up doing Monkey Boy, I forgot what it was like." I'm glad I've done everything sober.
Sherry O'Terry. Believe me, we're not catered to here. You go to L.A., you walk into offices for a meeting or something, and they ask, "Would you like a Snapple?" Here we have our refrigerators locked. They lock our refrigerators, or they cut back on our beverage consumption. And a lot of us just wait until they have to make popcorn for Lorne, and then we all go in like scavengers and eat the popcorn.
Ken Among, supervising producer. Actually, it was probably me, not some network executive, who gave the order to cut down on the food consumption. There's no question about it. I always look at the financial perspective of the show. I want it to go on forever. I look at the show from a variety of perspectives, and budgetary is certainly one of them. And every so often you sit down and look at it, like, how are you spending your money? It had to do with dinners. Where it became an issue was where I went to the writers and said, "One of the nights has to go away where the entire writing staff is being fed," or something along those lines. "One of them has to go, and you have to make a choice." And it turned out to be Wednesday, so I'm going to plead guilty to that. Warren Littlefield. Literally, there was one analysis where somebody said, "You know, villages could survive for quite some time on the weekly food budget for this show. Just insane amounts of stuff." We'd say, "Well, maybe you don't need that after-show party." And they'd go, "We can't do the show if we can't have the party." What everyone goes through that week, I think part of the richness of the experience that everyone feels they're doing something so great, so special, so wonderful, that bonds everybody together, is those after-hour parties. Jimmy Fallon. I'm 27 and I look 30, because I don't sleep anymore. I feel like I'm getting older fast. That's one thing they don't tell you about the job. You hear stories from other cast members like, "Hey man, good luck. Hang in there, because this place will kill you." One time I got so angry that I threw a phone out the window. And I'm thinking, I'd have to be mad at the phone company or the phone or something to throw a phone out the window. I'm on the 17th floor. Why would I throw anything out the window? I think I'm more humble than that. I'm like, at least I have a phone. What made anyone that angry that they got that mad? Andy Breckman. Reruns of the show are syndicated, and what happens is, every time a show is run, you get a little less money. The first time it's rerun, you get, I guess, close to half your salary. A nice check. And then the second time it's rerun, you get a little less, and a little less, and now it's on Comedy Central so often that what me and other writers get is just insane. What we get in the mail are piles of checks for 7 cents. Just piles of checks. And by the time you write your account number on the back of it and sign each one, your hand hurts. It's an ordeal. And that's what my career at SNL is down to now. Cramps in the hands and 7 cent checks. James Downey. One thing that has definitely changed, and this smells like the network to me, is that in the early years of Saturday Night Live, the show would very admirably use its clout when booking music acts. It was like, we're doing very well. We don't need to book a music act that's going to bring in huge numbers. So we would have some obscure, relatively obscure, or at least interesting choice. Like Sun Ra was on once. Nowadays, the choice of music seems, to me at least, entirely about getting kids to watch or earning a big rating. I think they've had, like, the Backstreet Boys on 2 or 3 times. And in the old days, that's the kind of thing that would have prompted a full-scale staff revolt. As far as the hosts, I have to admit there have been some in recent years whose names I did not recognize. I just didn't know who they were.